This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Do fish talk? Absolutely. That's according to scientists at the University of Hawaii who study fish behavior. Biologist Tim Trikas has spent several years recording the sounds of reef fish in an area off the Big Island. His groundbreaking research looked at how fish communicate and the messages they send, a kind of neighborhood watch. He joined us in our studios this week to talk about a different way to look at our undersea world.
We study fish behavior. And we like to study it both in the field and in the lab. So we bring fish into the lab and do all of our laboratory experiments. But the real wonderful portion of our research is to go out in the field and immerse underwater with them for long periods of time. We use rebreathers, and these are like scuba, except there's no bubbles. It recirculates the air and puts new oxygen in it, so we can stay down for 3 hours, anywhere between 60 and 100 feet, and get face-to-face right with the fish and watch their behavior while we're video recording it and also recording the sounds that they make with the hydrophone, which plugs right into the underwater camera. So we get very high-quality acoustics that are produced by the reef fishes.
So now, have you been targeting specific areas and just go back there and then collect this data over a period of time?
Right. So there's two phases. What I'm going to talk with you about today is there was the field portion with all the diving. Is the question was, how many coral reef fishes in Hawaii make sounds in their natural environment? Nobody had ever studied that before, almost on any coral reef around the world, certainly in Hawaii. So we spent 3 years. We had funding from NOAA and the Undersea Research Lab at the University of Hawaii. And what we were able to do is spend 3 years, not the entire 3 years, but maybe 4 or 5 months in the summer, and diving every day down on the Big Island, on the Kona coast, up the coast into South Kohala, where those reefs are essentially protected from fishermen and spear fishermen, so we have a really healthy ecosystem, much like Hanama Bay that we have here on Oahu.
Okay, and my experience with Hanama Bay is actually listening to a parrotfish munch on the reef, and I was shocked at how noisy that was.
That's right. So they have they're called a parrotfish because they have a parrot-like beak. It's actually the jaw and the teeth are all fused together on the top and the bottom. And what they do is they actually scrape the dead coral. Sometimes they'll nibble on a live coral. But what they're doing is they're scraping the small algae that is and detritus that's on the bottom. They have a mill, a gastric mill. Then they swim around and they poop out sand. It's pure sand that goes back down into the reef, and it concretes the reef together to make it stronger. So they're very important gardeners of the reef.
They're recyclers.
Oh, absolutely.
Now, we've got some sound files. Maybe we can take a listen if you can explain to us what we're going to be hearing.
So this is I believe this segment is a long-term underwater recording, just examples of what you might hear if you sat down underwater and didn't say anything or just listen to what was going on. So what you're hearing are snapping shrimp in the background, all that crackling. And in the background, those are fish talking to each other.
It's a symphony.
It's amazing when you go down there. And so you can go down during the day or night.
I kind of wonder, like, with all the concern about sonar testing, you know, and the effect on marine mammals, yeah, what does it do to the reef?
Okay, so there are experts in the effects of loud underwater sounds on marine mammals. I do know there's concerns that at close distance it can very much damage their inner ears, but I'm not the expert on that. I do know for a fact that pile driving and construction equipment that's banging, for example, pilings down for peers and things like that, they have such strong impact that it sends out extreme sound waves. The sound waves are so strong that they can damage the inner ears of fishes. And that's a big concern around the world. There's conferences around the world to be sensitive to the needs of the natural inhabitants of the aquatic environments.
I think folks who, let's say, snorkel or dive, you know, think, oh, there's just so much dead reef around. But really, it might not look brilliant, but there's life out there. It's amazing what marine life can survive in what we think are degraded waters.
That's true. And are you referring to Hawaii, certain
Yes.
areas of Hawaii? If you go snorkeling or scuba diving and survey areas, even in healthy reefs, you'll find that the abundance and diversity changes with habitat. If you go diving in Honolulu Harbor and don't get picked up by the feds, you will see fishes on the bottom there. But that's a sandy, silty, muddy bottom. But as soon as you get outside of the reef and start into rocky outcroppings, you'll see larger populations of fishes that use that rocky reef and live coral reefs as a living habitat. So you don't have to look very far to find healthy reefs.
I just recall, you know, when we had the molasses issue,
yes.
It was just amazing, though. You know, it did kill off a number of fish, but there was just an incredible amount of life that bounced back, that managed to survive in all of that.
Right. As I understand that molasses just spawned a whole deoxygenization of the water and everything that needed to breathe, ventilate underwater, suffocated. But once that was cleared out, it comes back pretty quickly because marine organisms, a lot of them have larvae that are in the water, maybe from offshore. New keiki came in and settled, both invertebrates and fishes.
And coral can be pretty resilient, as we've seen with some of the bleaching events. Sometimes what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, and we get more fortified coral, I guess, out there.
That's the story, as I understand it, especially for the corals that are over in Kaneohe Bay. There's a lot of research going on those corals. But the real issue in Hawaii is we are experiencing on this planet climate change. That's not a theory, that's a fact. And in fact, the sea temperatures in Hawaii have gone up about a degree and a half. I forget in the duration, the last 50 years or whatever. But they're expecting it to go up at least another 2 or 3 degrees by this mid-century or the end of this century. Our water is going to go up another 2 or 3 degrees in temperature, and that's going to have devastating effects on the living corals because they will undergo bleaching.
And are you doing any studies related to warming waters?
We're interested in the fish side of the story, right? So we can collaborate with coral reef managers and tell them why these uhu, for example, the parrotfishes, are so important for keeping the algae off the reef and not letting it overgrow onto living corals. And they also, when they scratch the bottom to feed, they make new settlement sites for coral larvae to come in and start growing new colonies.
We've got another audio file to listen to. Now, what's that?
That is a mimpachi. That is a small red fish. It's a very popular fish. That's the Japanese name for it. It was actually, the Hawaiian name is u'u, because the Hawaiians gave it that name. If you go back into the old literature, when they pick it up, it would go u'u, u'u, so they called it an u'u. And that fish makes sounds on the reef when it's approached by a predator, a large jack coming by, or if a shark swims by, or a big diver and a rebreather comes up to look at it, they'll start making several different types of sounds.
Wow, that's so really interesting.
They're the town crier for events on the reef.
Wow, that's a great way to put it. I mean, because people don't connect sometimes what they see in the ocean and hear what's actually happening.
all you have to do is have a little bit of time and a little quiet and put a hydrophone in the water and hook it up to your smartphone and start recording, just like you would with a microphone. So we have ideas of using this acoustic monitoring to automate it and be able to, on reefs of that are in, say, good reefs or reefs that are stressed, maybe with some recent bleaching, to put these acoustic recorders out on the reef and send that information back in real time so the managers, conservation biologists, can know what's going on. Say, for example, in the case of the parrotfish that are really important for keeping the limu down on the reef.
In all your years in doing this research, was there anything that surprised you, startled you, that was just unexpected?
Oh, the 3 years we spent on the reef recording the acoustics that are made by fishes, it was like exploring the moon. We could stay down there for 3 hours on a dive, and we would see the fish going through, and we thought we heard sounds, but we really couldn't analyze it till we got back into the apartment and, you know, had nice earphones to get high-quality sounds. And we knew oo-oo made sounds, but we think that they also make sounds to not just warn other individuals of their own species, but other related species on the reef. So we think because the oo-oo starts making sound when it sees a large predator, and then we hear other species down the reef starting to produce sound too, such as they're not just communicating with their own species, they're providing information for the whole reef.
Right, so it's an alarm system, kind of alerting them, danger, danger.
Right, and that's very anthropocentric. We're thinking, you know, we think we're thinking like fish, but yes, very literally, that's what we think's happening.
Gosh, anything else you'd like to share? I mean, you're gonna be talking about a number of things at this lecture. Fascinating, though.
Right. Thank you. I will. It's a talk that's targeted towards the general public, so I won't get too scientific and you know how boring scientists can be. But we're trying to connect the public through this program that the Waikiki Aquarium has. It's an innovative lecture series targeted at the public, so for them to understand their marine environments, and also how you can take science and use it for conservation.
That was UH scientist Tim Trikas talking about the research into fish behavior on our coral reefs. He'll be featured in the Waikiki Aquarium's upcoming Distinguished Lecture Series to discuss the coral reef fish of Hawaii. Many fish, many sounds, and many pictures. There's a video component there, too. So it takes place a week from today on Thursday, October 17th at Tenney Theater. Trikas will share insights on Hawaii's coral reefs, the approximately 600 species of fish that live there, and the new bioacoustic technique that's been invaluable to coral reef research.
Hi, this is Marco Werman calling from the World Program in Boston.
Oh, hello, my friend.
Are you ready to talk about pufferfish and making deadly foods non-deadly? Take a little pull on it and tell us what you're tasting.
If I breathe, you can actually hear me nosing it, right?
That's a nose. It's the first time, I've got to say, I've heard the trumpet used as a percussion instrument. Join us on The World.
This afternoon at 1.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. In today's backyard quiz, we look at the Honolulu estate of one of its most prominent businessmen. Walter Dillingham was born for industry. His father, Benjamin, founded Oahu Railway and Land Company. Before the age of 30, he managed ORNL and ran his own business, Hawaiian Dredging Company. His businesses transformed the landscapes of Pearl Harbor, Waikiki, and harbors across the state. In 1910, he married Louise Gaylord in a Renaissance-era villa near Florence, Italy. Inspired by that location, they hired Chicago architect David Adler to build their home with elements from several Italian villas. And after years of site searching and construction, Dillingham, his wife, and four children moved into the estate in 1922. It hosted luminaries visiting the islands, including President Franklin D. Roosevelt and Walt Disney. When he died in 1962, he gifted the home to Punahou School to be used as the school president's house. Since it was too far from campus, the president decided not to live there. However, a then-fledgling school bought the property, welcoming its first class in 1969. What school sits on that property today? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you think you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
This week on Says You.
You did not need glitty glop gloopy nibby nobby noopy la 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 lo.
Oh, I'm not so sure we didn't.
Imagine how stupid you felt singing that naked.
A game as fast as it's fun, and everyone's a winner. Says You.
Tonight is 6:30 following Marketplace.
Aloha. I'm Eunice Sim from Hawaii Baptist Academy, and you're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
It is now time for our reality check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. We check in on the latest developments on illegal adoptions in our backyard. Investigations editor John Hill has an update on a story they've been tracking for a year now. Good morning, John.
Hi, Catherine.
So you folks really put the spotlight on this problem, and there's been some action finally.
That's right. It was almost a year ago that we published our initial story saying that there were a handful of lawyers in the U.S. who were bringing Marshallese birth mothers to the U.S., flying them in for adoptions and contravention of the treaty between the two nations. And that was about a year ago. And then just earlier this week, one of the primary players in this adoption black market pipeline was indicted in three different states, actually, in Arkansas, Arizona, and Utah, and federal charges and state charges against Paul Peterson, who also happens to be the elected assessor of Maricopa County, Arizona.
So they've had, news conferences to talk about these indictments, right?
Yeah, it was kind of a big deal in all these places because he's a public official, I think, partly. And so there was almost simultaneous press conferences in three different places announcing the charges, very serious charges against him, actually. He's facing, just on the federal charges, 315 years in prison. I don't think that will happen, but that's technically what could happen.
I mean, we're talking trafficking. This is like the black market.
Yeah, that's what the prosecutor said. They said it was a very clear example of human trafficking. They said that the women, I think it was in the Arkansas press conference, the women who had been brought to Arkansas by this attorney were kind of held incommunicado, sometimes 14 to a house, 4 to a bedroom. They were pregnant women, but they were sleeping on the floor with no beds. And so they didn't really have a lot of choice about where they went or what they did. I mean, I don't think they were physically restrained, but nobody said that. But they were in a place where they didn't know the language, and they were really held sort of incommunicado in these places.
No, you know, I have limited knowledge about the different, you know, Micronesian cultures, but my understanding was this definition of adoption is really different from what, you know, the Western definition and what it is in the Marshallese community.
That's true, and that's at the heart of what's been going on and the problem with what's been going on with these attorneys, because in the Marshall Islands, there's a long tradition of informal child sharing where a child might go live with a relative or a friend for a while, but then they come back, and you never – it's almost unheard of, as I understand it, in the Marshall Islands to formally sever your claim on a child and never see them again. But, of course, that is our model in the U.S., and for whatever reason, I mean, this is, I think, kind of an interesting question. For whatever reason, the women who we interviewed, the Marshallese birth mothers, were still under the impression that their children would come back to them when they turned 18, or that they would still be able to see them even though they went with a different family. I mean, in some cases, these were open adoptions, but in a lot of cases, open adoptions are only open as long as the adoptive parents want them to be. So there, we heard stories of parents who had, adoptive parents who had cut off contact with the birth mothers. So yes, there is this cultural clash, I think, in the understanding of what adoption is, and that was really at the heart of the exploitation of these women.
It is heartbreaking, you know, to read your story and to read the details, because not only were they promised money, but then they were never really paid the full amount.
That's true, yeah. In a lot of cases, they siphoned off money for their living expenses, and even though they weren't living in great circumstances, or we still don't know a lot of the details. We heard stories when we were doing the reporting, but yeah, and then they were living in really not great conditions, and there were a lot of ways that they were mistreated or allegedly mistreated.
So you've got these investigations in three different states. What else is ahead?
Well, that's an interesting question, because I spoke yesterday to the U.S. attorney in Arkansas, and he said there would be other indictments coming down regarding other players in the black market Marshallese business. And our story has identified other lawyers who do very much the same thing, according to what we heard and people we interviewed. So it'll be interesting to see if those lawyers now are subject to these kinds of charges, very serious charges. Now, this has gone on for more than a decade. In fact, this lawyer in Arizona who just was indicted, as far back, in our original stories, I reported that in 2007, there were judges in Arizona who were talking about how he was breaking the law. And so now we're 12 years later, and finally he has been indicted. So this has been going on the whole time. We'll see now if this is part of a larger crackdown.
And so I have to ask, you know, what happens to the children then that are in these homes? I wonder what those families think.
Well, that is an interesting question. But the prosecutors in all the states were careful to say that they would not be challenging the adoptions, and they say that the Marshallese women are not interested in challenging the adoptions, although I wonder about that. But it seems like those adoptions will stay put.
Okay. All right. Well, the interesting story, and kudos for looking at it. You know, there's been finally a crackdown after all this time. So thanks.
Well, thank you, Catherine. Thanks.
That was editor John Hill on the latest on the adoption scheme targeting vulnerable Micronesian mothers. To read the full story, visit civilbeat.org.
There can be a lot of psychological noise involved in teaching.
A plus.
Great job.
Great job.
You keep messing up. How are you not getting
Way
this?
Way to go.
Let's try that.
But what if you replace all that chit-chat with a click? How an animal training tool is helping new surgeons learn their craft. This week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Tonight at 7, following Says You.
Thank you.
kuleana. It's the Hawaiian word for responsibility. It's also the original title of a locally produced movie that enjoyed a 7-week, 13-theater run in Guam and Hawaii. It screened in over 40 cities across the U.S. in 2018, grossing over $200,000. The mystery drama is set in Maui in 1971. Film creator Brian Cohn lives on Maui, but was in town to support the state's Creative Lab Hawaii at tonight's grand opening of Entrepreneur Sandbox, a new Kaka'ako facility. The film, Kuleana, got its start in Creative Lab, and Cohn shares the hard lesson he's learned about trying to be true to culture in the movie industry.
The script was a part of the 2014 Writers Intensive for Creative Lab Hawaii. And so I workshopped the script there, and my connection with the lab has been wonderful.
So talk about its development, because now the film is Kuleana Maui.
Correct. Yeah, we released as Kuleana to film festivals in 2017, and also in theaters as Kuleana. We held 40 event screenings on the mainland, and what we discovered was that we went as far as we could. On the mainland, the only people that were showing up for the movie were former Hawaii people, so the title wasn't accessible to an outside audience, is what it sort of proved. So we made the adjustment, so now that we're going into wider release from Hawaii, the movie is Kuleana Maui on DVD and Blu-ray and VOD. However, the movie will be released exclusively as Maui to international territories and for domestic television and streaming services.
What do you mean introduced as Maui?
Maui, the movie will be called Maui. It will be known as Maui. It's being released internationally and to domestic television exclusively as Maui, whereas we're releasing to Blu-ray and DVD as Kuleana Maui.
That's just so interesting. I mean, I guess when you first had this idea and then you tried to find a perfect title and, you know, Kuleana, I mean, that's a very powerful word.
Yeah.
But like you said, a lot of the mainstream folks, like, what is Kuleana? They've never heard of it. They don't know what it is.
Correct. And at the end of the day, motion pictures, it's a business. And so you need to find a way to market your films. Branding's really important. At the end of the day, motion pictures, it's a business. And so we produced as Kuleana, but in order to market, we need to be open to a change in titling. Our sales agent, American Cinema International, if we did not proactively establish an alternate title as Maui, they would have sold it into international territories, and anybody who licenses the work would then be free to change the title to whatever they'd want. So it was really important for us to search deeply. And so the title Maui is appropriate. It takes place on Maui. It's about issues related to Maui in 1971. The movie is still about Kuleana. It is the same movie. But, you know, this is actually a really common thing. We just don't tend to think of it because in America, we see movies that are retitled all the time, movies that were produced outside of the United States. When they're marketed to the United States, there's usually some title designed that we can identify with, something accessible. So I think it's just hard for some people in Hawaii to wrap their head around, why would you have to change your title? Why would you change your title? Well, it's a business, and if we want people the world over to see our movie, they first have to want to see the movie, and that begins with with a title that they can recognize.
Okay, so basically, the movies morph.
Yes.
Based on the economic need, I guess.
Correct. Yeah, you work to open yourself up to a broad audience. Maui is a pretty familiar brand, and for our movie, it's certainly not a compromise. It remains authentic as Maui. If we did not make the change, for example, in Spain, it could be marketed in Spanish along the lines of Murder in Maui, you know. So Maui, as a title, is unlikely to get translated anywhere in the world.
So I guess the lesson learned, what advice would you give to other aspiring filmmakers, knowing what you know now?
Yeah, well, what I would say to the Hawaii filmmaker is, in development, especially a cultural motion picture, is think about two markets. Think about Hawaii as, you know, our home market, our region, our country. and think about the title that's going to connect with people from Hawaii, in and from Hawaii, but also give some thought to what that title might be when marketed outside of the islands, outside of our culture, because if you do not make these decisions and your work does get sold into international territories, those decisions will be made without your input.
So there's really a whole dimension, this whole thing on distribution. There's so much to learn about.
Absolutely, absolutely. And when you're titling of a work, when you're writing a work, you want to have a title that inspires actors, inspires, you know, producers and other people to want to be involved. But when you're producing, you know, that's simply a working title. And then when you first go to market, that's the first time that you slap a label on it, and you tend to do it based on, you know, where it is you're debuting and what market it is that you're going after.
You know, what comes to mind is the film about Princess Kaiulani that was slugged Barbarian Princess. A lot of folks didn't like that. A lot of folks didn't like that title.
Oh, truly. And that's a very, very good example. Is here you had outside entities imposing that title because, you know, they figured that would sell tickets outside of the state of Hawaii, which is probably true. However, how deeply, you know, insulting it is to our culture and to our, you know, such a important historical figure. So I think with Hawaii as content creators, we just have to wrap our heads around these challenges, these issues. We have to be realistic. It is a business. If you want to sell your motion pictures to the world, if you want people to see them, then we do need to think of ways that, you know, that we can present our works without, you know, having to compromise, you know, the artistic integrity, if you will.
Yes. How do you keep the integrity? How do you go from poke to pokey, you know, and not have your work kind of hijacked?
Yeah, it is an absolute challenge, and people in the industry, you know, are just accustomed to this is sort of the way things work. But as the independent content creator working in the state of Hawaii, you know, we're creating an industry, and I'm always quick to point out that, you know, because we're creating an industry from the ground up, we can do so based in our values, and we can come up with all kinds of ways to create an industry that we want to be a part of that maybe doesn't directly mirror the way things work in Hollywood. But at the end of the day, the buck stops somewhere, and, you know, if you want those eyeballs outside of our small region, you're gonna have to do whatever it is necessary to appeal to those individuals.
Right. You've got to have the bird's eye view and not just be fixated on trying to create a film, getting the film produced, but then, like you said, having eyeballs on it.
Yes. And in our case, you know, I've had a few people say, well, how come you chicken out? You know, I certainly didn't do that. I'm more stubborn than most. You know, we did market as Kuleana through film festivals, through event screenings, through theaters. I really, you know, hammered and ran into that wall as hard as I possibly could. We had a sales agent working hard to market the motion picture as Kuleana and went to all of the international marketplaces. And quite frankly, people were having trouble pronouncing the word. Our sales agents alone were having trouble describing it, let alone describing, you know, the complexities of a story that takes place, you know, in Hawaii about a people of whom there are few. So it's not as though we didn't give it our best shot exclusively as Kuleana. But again, I don't feel like there's a compromise. In Hawaii, with the release of the Blu-ray DVD on October 20th, we are selling the motion picture as Kuleana Maui, and I feel very good about that title.
All right. Well, thank you so much. Thanks for that insight into this.
Yeah,
it's,
for sure.
It's good advice for young filmmakers to be thinking about.
Yes, truly. And young filmmakers, I'm the program coordinator for creative media at the University of Hawaii Maui College. I'm part of the Academy of Creative Media system statewide, and I'm really, 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 I feel really good about where we're headed. The youth are making movies in Hawaii. We're getting better, and I think this is where it's going to start. The future for motion pictures like Kuleana are going to be when our native speakers ascend to an age of maturity and become capable with, you know, the complexities of our craft, I think we're gonna experience some really powerful cultural storytelling up the road here. If the students that I'm working with are any indication, you know, people in Hawaii are extraordinarily talented, and now that the tools are accessible and people are able to make motion pictures, you know, without having to go to Hollywood, I like to think that a lot of our talent, you know, will remain in Hawaii, and maybe some of our talent that's gone away and has been working on the mainland for many years, maybe they'll start to have opportunities to come home and tell story, you know, from our perspective. So yeah. In the case of Olelo Hawaii, you know, mm-hmm. the Hawaiian culture is embedded in the language, so this unique perspective, this worldview is definitely, you know, in the native speakers in a way that someone like myself, you know, I've lived here all my life, but a lot of my perspectives are secondhand or more so as an observer, which is different than being, you know, being authentically rooted in the Hawaiian culture.
That was Kuleana writer, ender, and film director Brian Cohn. He tells us the movie will be released to nationwide audiences through video on demand, pay-per-view, and to international territories under the title Maui. Kuleana Maui goes to Blu-ray DVD on October 20th.
Aloha, I'm Kalava Correa from the Smithsonian's Asian Pacific American Center. Hear the conversation live or anytime you want on the HPR mobile app. Find it in the Apple App Store or on Google Play.
In today's backyard quiz, we were looking for the name of the school that sits on the old Dillingham estate, which happens to be the name of the villa where Walter Dillingham married his wife, Louise Gaylord. The industrialist whose businesses included Oahu Railway and Land Company and Hawaiian Dredging Company built a luxurious property on the slopes of Diamond Head. From the lanai, you can see clear across Oahu's south shore to the Waianae Mountains. The grounds included a field large enough to play polo. Dillingham and his sons were avid players, and while he lived there, Dillingham hosted visiting dignitaries at his home, including FDR. When he passed away, the building was donated to Punahou School to be used as the school president's house, but the school president decided not to live there. Meanwhile, the Hawaii School for Girls opened in 1964 at Central Union Church, but its founder wanted a new campus. They were able to raise money to purchase the building and held its first class there in 1969. The school is now known today as La Pietra, named after Villa La Pietra, and was the answer to today's quiz. Congratulations to Arthur Park for getting it right, and congratulations to all the numerous callers who called in, many proud graduates and proud parents. That's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. KTUH celebrated its 50th anniversary this year. The student-run college station started as the passion project of a handful of music-loving students operating out of Hawaii Hall at the University of Hawaii Manoa, which aired its first broadcast in 1969. Then, much of the station's focus was politics and current affairs. Now, KTUH focuses most of its efforts on providing the community with eclectic, independent music free from corporate influence. In observance of its golden anniversary, KTUH recently put on a series of concerts that played host to a number of the station's many alumni, including the Conversation's own Harrison Patino. He was able to sit down with a fellow alumnus, Fred Barbaria, the station's first general manager. He looks back on the 50 years of student-run radio and how the station has changed since its humble beginnings in the 1960s.
In 1966, which precedes the 50-year span, Ken Kuniyuki and I were both students at the College of Engineering at UH. And I kind of had the radio bug because I'd been at University of California at Davis the year before. And basically, I was majoring in radio, not in the engineering classes I was supposed to be taking. The way it turned out is Ken was interested as well. He was an ASUH senator. We found some equipment up at Hawaii Hall that the speech communications department had still owned, but the station they were running, evidently, the budget was cut in the late 50s by the legislature. So that was the end of that. You know, they had paid staff. And I think they mostly ran classical music, but they were actually Hawaii's first non-commercial public radio station. But KTUH came after that. The equipment was there languishing. It was all monophonic. It was all vacuum tube. It was old stuff.
It sounded like it sprang forth from some really industrious repurposing. And I imagine there might have been some technical challenges in the early days. What kind of hurdles did you guys have to jump through to get things on the air?
Well, after we got the audio equipment running, our engineer at the time, Chris Harrison, had to build some little AM closed circuit transmitters. And these, we call them the death transmitters because they were plugged into three-phase power in the basement of the East-West Center and the dorms. But they fed the radio signal into the wiring in the dorm, and then you could pick it up on an AM radio. And that was our test. We had to prove to the administration that we could actually operate a station and keep it going. And we actually ran that longer than KUOH, the old FM station, ran.
I'm hoping that's an abstract name and it didn't actually claim any student casualties.
Yeah, no casualties. No students were harmed.
So now KTUH has a pretty significant reach, almost all of Oahu. What was the original signal reach? Where were you reaching in the early days of the station?
Well, it varied. It depended on what you were trying to listen with and where you were. If you were down in Waikiki, you were just overwhelmed by all the 50,000-watt stations, which are way overpowered for an island this size. And you would find, with the old FM radios, you'd find those stations 10 places on the dial. It was a real challenge, but we were even sending people instructions on how to make a dipole antenna to put on the back of their FM set, because they didn't need that for the other stations. But it was really Kaimuki to Kakaako.
So we're marking 50 years. In your eyes, what's changed most significantly since 1969?
I think the focus has changed a little. We were very heavily into public news and public affairs back then. On campus, there was a lot of stuff going on, everything from the protests to speeches to symposiums, and you know, you name it, it goes on at the university. And we had a remote crew that would go out and either bring these back live through tie lines. We were wired into Kennedy Theater and Andrews Amphitheater and Hemingway Hall. They're doing a different kind of public affairs. It's been an evolution. But the music, the block formatting is the same. The fact that you can find the same type of music, usually with the same DJ, playing the same day of the week, time of day, each week, is one of the hallmarks of what has stayed.
Yeah, I mean, you were coming out of 1969. It was a socially and politically tumultuous, not just year, but a few years, an era. You had the Summer of Love fresh in mind. How did that period really shape the early ethos of the station?
Well, it really made the DJs take chances with the music they played. They would find music they liked, wouldn't be played on the AM stations of the day, or even the FM stations of the day, and they would go ahead and play it. I mean, Hawaii was always kind of out of step with the mainland anyway as far as what was popular, but we were out of step with both of those things. And we'd play obscure songs by the Jefferson Airplane that never made the top 40, probably never made the top 100.
How old were you when you started?
Well, I was 23 when we went FM, so I was one of the older students at that point.
What was the name of your show?
It didn't have a name, but that's part of what's happened is the shows didn't have names. It was just rock with or classical with. You know, people didn't use many DJ names. I used Fred Fox for a while because it was easier to pronounce.
So as we come up on 50 years, how can you kind of put so many decades of college radio into perspective, what it means to the community as a whole.
To the community, it's just, it's been such an asset to both the UH and the community at large. It's an alternative. And being that it's student-run, it can be a little weird sometimes. It can even be a little off the wall sometimes. But it's part of the beauty of it, the fact that the students can take chances. I mean, they have to stay within FCC guidelines and that sort of thing, but they don't have to exercise good taste all the time necessarily either. And that's been from day one. There were a couple of people that I had to let go at the time, way back, when they just stepped over the line too many times. But that was then, and now they probably would get away with it and get a pat on the head for it.
Do you have any anecdotes from that era that might be safe for radio?
Most of them I don't remember, thankfully. You know, then there were all the concerts that we sponsored. That was a whole other story.
What were some of your favorite concerts?
The big one was Blue Oyster Cult, which was the one that actually shut down Andrews as a venue for years. That one was incredible. I got a note from, I don't have it with me, unfortunately, from Hank McMonagle. He worked for KTUH. They had pyrotechnics, and they had lasers shooting in the sky, and they were water-cooled lasers because they were huge. The crowd outside was bigger than the crowd inside. And by the time they got the second night, they had such a crowd, they had shut down Dole Street. They called the riot police, and they were telling John Leonard they were going to arrest him if he didn't shut it down. And his director of security, who was an ex-HPD officer, told them that if they shut it down, they probably would have a riot on their hands, so it was better to let it go. But they were getting noise complaints from Diamond Head and Waikiki. It was so loud.
As we look back on 50 years, we're kind of noticing that these sort of student-run radio stations or these independent radio stations are becoming fewer and farther in between, and the idea of music that is just being put out there solely from the input of the DJs is a rarer and rarer thing. How important is that to you looking forward to the future of college radio?
To me, that's super important. That's what differentiates radio and college radio from the rest of the world. I mean, you can have stuff that Pandora puts together or Spotify or whoever, but it's never going to be the same because the interrelationships between the songs, between the musicians, and between the music itself are something that we hear as human beings, something that the curator can see and hear. And if the show is put together carefully, it's going to be a much better show than anything you would ever hear put together mechanically, even though the mechanical people have an infinite number of recordings to draw from. You know, they're just on a shelf digitally, but I'm still into vinyl. I did an all-vinyl show for the alumni takeover back in July, and I actually took all the vinyl I had, transcribed that into WAV files, and then edited the whole thing together into segments. But I'm thinking about coming back next year to do a live show for the takeover.
I should hope so. You just can't beat the feeling of knowing that there's somebody behind that microphone.
Well, I think there was a little bit. I heard a couple of days ago that people were calling for me during the show.
Well, they just wanted to hear your music, or they wanted to talk story?
Wanted to talk story.
Oh, okay.
And maybe had a request, but I couldn't do either.
Well, you can call them back then.
Yeah.
Fred, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're very welcome.
Well, it's 1969, okay.
Nice. That was the Conversations, Harrison Patino, speaking with Fred Barbieri, the first general manager of UH Manoa's student-run radio station, KTUH, which marks its 50th anniversary this year. And we should give a nod to KTUH alum who now work here at HPR, Lillian Song, Nikki, Connor Medeiros, Zoe Dime, David Carranza, Leonardo, Casey Harlow, Paige Okimura, and Ray Cruz.
It's your thing. Do what you wanna do. I can't tell you who to sock it to. It's your thing. Do what you wanna do. I can't tell you who to sock it to.
That is it for today. Up tomorrow, we mark the 10,000 milestone in electric vehicle sales in the state with a call-in show, All Things EV. Tell us what's on your mind. Call our talkback line and leave us a comment in your voice. The number to do that, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We are on Facebook at The Conversation HPR and Twitter at HI Conversation. And if you missed any of this show and want to find a past one, go to our conversation page. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.